Welcome to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. Michelle Rayner with you this afternoon. And two features today which explore the lives of women in the late 19th century. Later, sex and moral panic in colonial Melbourne. But our first story today is set against that mighty cascade of water on the border between New York State and Canada. That honeymooner's cliché, tourist trap, suicide capital, and nature wonder of the world, Niagara Falls. In the 19th century, Niagara Falls became a stage for daredevils and tourism stunts. In the age of live spectacle, before the advent of film, a succession of high divers, tightrope walkers, and intrepid swimmers made their mark in and around the furious waters of Niagara, to the delight and thrill of crowds thronging at the water's edge. But until 1901, no one had dared to challenge the falls themselves, to try and go over the terrifying precipice and survive. The person who took on this challenge was a rather unlikely gravity hero. And in the end, the net profit of the stunt in the life of its brave and desperate protagonist was gravely disappointing. Not the usual carnival show-off. Annie Edson-Taylor at Niagara Falls is produced by Catherine Franey.
My God, she's alive.
The woman is alive.
She didn't die, but it's a really sad story anyway.
She was desperate to become financially independent.
Shot Niagara Falls and lives to profit by it.
Oh, I would have liked to watch the people on the riverbank. I could imagine them straining their eyes for a glimpse of the barrel, tumbling and tossing in huge waves. In another 5 seconds, I should reach the crest of the falls.
Mrs. Annie Edson-Taylor went over Niagara Falls yesterday afternoon and survived. A feat never before accomplished and indeed never attempted, except in the commission of suicide.
At that instant, thousands would hold their breath and stare in fascinated horror. They would tremble with expectation as I dropped over the brink down to the chasm far below.
I'm Garrett Soden. I'm the author of a book called Falling, How Our Greatest Fear Became Our Greatest Thrill. It looks at the history of people that have challenged gravity in a number of ways, skydivers, mountain climbers, and stunt people. And so that includes Annie Taylor, who was the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel.
The Cataract Journal, October 17, 1901. Mrs. Annie Edson-Taylor of Bay City, Michigan, has been in town for a week arranging to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Mrs. Taylor announces frankly her feat is to make money to provide for herself, believing as the only person ever to perform the stunt, she will be a great drawing card on the lecture platform and in shows. Attempts have been made to induce her to alter her plans and make a trip through the Whirlpool Rapids, but she has steadfastly refused, and yesterday afternoon, she declared she'd go over the falls on the coming Sabbath.
It'll be fame and fortune or instant death.
My name is Suzette Meyer, and I'm a novelist. I started researching water and bodies of water, and specifically Canadian bodies of water, and I stumbled across all of this information, this history around Niagara Falls. And then there was a footnote about this woman, Annie Edson-Taylor, and I was absolutely riveted by this. I thought it was so bizarre. I just couldn't understand that I didn't know about this. I couldn't believe that it was actually real.
Oh my goodness. Oh.
What is it?
The barrel is leaking.
How much water is it?
Is it about a pailful?
Well, that won't hurt you, Annie.
Oh my goodness.
We're going to cast you off now. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The thing about her that's really interesting to me is, A, that she was 63 when she did this. The other thing, too, is that she did this remarkable, remarkable thing, but nobody's heard of her.
Yeah, she's not very well known at all, and in fact, she wasn't that well known at the time. comparatively. The local newspapers right around Niagara Falls did make a big deal of it, but that was boosterism, you know, that was tourism. The rest of the country really didn't take much notice at all. The amazing thing about Annie is that she came at a time when the idea of a gravity hero had been building for a long time. In the late 1700s, the parachute was invented, and the first people to use the parachute were performers. They would go up for crowds, and they would jump out of the parachute, and people would pay to watch that. And it steadily grew. You had high divers. In the early 1800s, there was a man named Sam Patch who used to dive off waterfalls. All these men, and they were all men without exception, looked at the heroic aspect of this. They compared themselves to Napoleon. They compared themselves to generals going out to battle nature. In the midst of all this, you had a number of people clamoring to be the first to go over Niagara Falls and to be that ultimate gravity hero. And here comes Annie Taylor. She's a 63-year-old woman. She's not athletic in any way. She's plump.
For 2 years, I had been constantly studying, when not occupied in teaching, what I could do to make money, to make it honestly and quickly. All kinds of schemes ran riot through my brain. Late one evening, I sat alone reading a New York paper. I laid the paper down, and the idea came to me like a flash of light. Go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. No one has ever accomplished this feat, and this, if well managed, should bring me ready money. The moment this idea came into my head, I answered as though spoken to, "This is what I will do."
We need to look at where Annie came from. She was a farmer's daughter. She was born in 1838 and raised in Auburn, New York. She apparently got out of there fairly early. She married, but unfortunately her husband died in the Civil War. She was left without any support. She was always described as a very independent woman, but she seemed to go on a real wandering streak. She got a degree in education. She taught for 3 years and then got a degree in dance. She was a dance instructor, and she started being an itinerant dance instructor. She went to a number of different cities. She taught in Chattanooga, Birmingham, San Francisco. She even opened a school in Bay City, Michigan, which is where she had relatives, but the school failed. She did this for almost 30 years, teaching dancing in these various cities, but as she aged, it became harder and harder to get students. So finally what happened in 1901, now we'll bring it up to the point where she's about to make this decision. She's now 63. She's living off of relatives, but she was desperate to become financially independent.
For years, I had taught physical culture, was an expert. I therefore knew how to plan a trip on scientific principles. Diameter at the top, 22 inches. Diameter at the middle, 34 inches. I measured and drew the dimensions of a barrel I thought would best stand the awful journey. I made a paper model sewn together with twine. Height, 4.5 feet. Weight, 160 pounds. I sought a cooper and had much trouble persuading him to make the barrel. He exclaimed, "My God, you'll be killed. Me helping, I can't do it. You'll drown. If that barrel hit a rock, it would smash to pieces. I can't make a barrel that strong. You go and find some other cooper to make it if you want to get yourself killed." I returned to his shop several times. He finally consented, and I told him exactly what to do. I selected the lumber to see that each piece was perfect and stood by and watched as the barrel was made. The lumber I picked out was Kentucky oak of 1.5 inches in thickness, and I had each stave oiled, thinking the barrel would shed water better because of the oiling. In the head of the barrel was located a manhole, 12 by 14 inches, covering the manhole was a bar of wood, 4 inches thick. Through this lid, a heavy iron screw ran. A bar dropped over this, and a nut placed on the screw was fastened down by a wrench. Securely fastened to the bottom of the barrel with iron straps was a blacksmith's anvil weighing about 175 pounds. This was used to keep the top of the barrel upwards in all events.
She was just going to lock herself in a barrel and drop herself over the falls. And if that's not exposing yourself as a victim to nature, I don't know what is. As soon as you go into a barrel, you become a victim because you're enclosed in this thing and you're just tossing yourself on the water and letting the river have at you.
I don't know about the idea that it requires no skill, that it's strictly placing yourself in the position of victim. You know, I think that she was a desperate person, certainly, and I think that likely what it was go big or go home, so die in a giant extravagant way or make a lot of money and become famous. But is that about masochism? I don't know if that's about masochism. I don't see her as a victim in that way. I think she was either incredibly foolish and or incredibly brave. I think it took a tremendous amount of bravery and imagination, tremendous imagination, that she decided, why not me?
I'm not the usual carnival show-off. I've had a scientific education. I was an accomplished musician and dancer. Many have furthered their career due to my teaching. So what does it mean? I've never made a fortune. Many of my relatives are not concerned with my welfare. Many of them shun me as though I were afflicted with the plague.
The next thing that she does is she hires a manager, a man named Frank Russell. Now, Russell was a high dive promoter, and so he had been involved in stunts. She told him that she was only 42 years old. I don't know whether he believed it or not, but he wound up repeating that. She was actually 63. After only 3 months of planning, she sent Russell to Niagara Falls to announce to the press that this event was going to happen. Now, a few days later, Annie shows up at Niagara Falls and greets the reporters, and they're sort of stunned because she's obviously not 42. And in the wake of this history that we have of burly men, parachutists and high divers and the like, now we see a woman who claims she's going to go over Niagara Falls. Not only is it a woman, not only is she 63, she's anything but athletic.
Ladies and gentlemen, the queen of the mist, the heroine of Niagara Falls, Mrs. Annie Edson Taylor.
Now, we have to imagine what it must have been like for her. She had these two assistants, and they got in a rowboat and rowed over to Grass Island. They had the barrel, and they put it out in the water, and the two assistants got it ready, and Annie took off. She was wearing a long black skirt, a white blouse, a black jacket, and a big broad-brimmed black hat. Once again, not looking like an adventuress so much as a schoolmarm. So she took off her hat and her jacket, and she climbed into the barrel. She crouched down. Her assistants put the lid on. She was very concerned about suffocating in the barrel. She was concerned about this because a woman who had gone through the whirlpools in Niagara had suffocated. By the time they got her out of the barrel, she was dead. So Annie was very concerned about this. She asked one of the assistants to pump air into the barrel with a bicycle pump, which he dutifully did, although that didn't make any difference because as soon as they put the barrel in the water, it started leaking. It wasn't airtight in the first place. So imagine her. She's sitting inside this barrel. It's dark. She's holding on to these handles. The smell of soaked wood is around her, and she's hearing the river. And in the bottom of the barrel, there's, you know, about 8 inches of sloshing water covering her feet, which is freezing.
I can feel the barrel toss and even partly turn over. Now I entered the smooth, swift current that makes its way around the bend in the river.
People stood by the hundreds with ashen faces, spellbound, watching the dark speck rushing towards the center of the great horseshoe of water.
For the first time, I could hear the roar of the falls. As I faced the inevitable, life or a horrible death in 50 minutes, my courage rose. I tore the cushion from my head, placed it quickly under my knees, and dropped to the bottom of the barrel. I clasped my hands tightly, relaxing every muscle in my body. I dropped my head on my breast when I realized I was on the brink of the awful precipice. The barrel seemed to pause for 1 second. Then, as swift as thought, it made the awful plunge of 158 feet to the boiling waters far below.
She hears the river drop away, and she feels herself sort of float out into space, realizing that she's gone over the falls.
I knew I was falling by the feeling that something had given out from under me. The sensation was one of indescribable horror. I felt as though all nature was being annihilated.
Now, she's bracing for the impact when she hits the surface. She's really concerned that that's going to knock her out.
Holy God, holy and mighty, holy immortal one, have mercy upon me.
Amazingly, she doesn't feel it. Instead, what happens is tons of water is just funneling her down into the throat of Niagara Falls, so there is not a surface to hit.
There was no sensation of striking the waters in the lower river. I simply knew I was in the terrifying cauldron at the base of the falls. I went down, far below the surface. Not a sound reached my ears. I felt alone, cold, forsaken.
Now she's probably a couple of dozen feet underwater. And momentarily she feels herself rising, and she feels the barrel being shot out of the water.
The barrel came up under the water, pouring over the precipice. It was then I began to suffer. The barrel was picked up like a feather, dashed violently around in midair. Struck on the rocks, cold water was forcing itself in. My strength was fast giving way. The barrel then shot out from the cataract like an arrow from a bow, giving me a frightful lurch.
The barrel floated into an eddy near a huge rock about 500 yards from the base of the falls.
All at once, I heard the barrel grate upon the rocks. It was at that instant I knew I was saved. My senses immediately left me. My head dropped forward. Like a person falling to sleep, I became unconscious.
As the barrel floated by the rock, engineer John Ross of the steamer Maid of the Mist retrieved it with a long pole and drew it close. In a second, the barrel was drawn up on the rock and the manhole cover was removed. Engineer Ross got down on his hands and knees and peered inside.
The woman is alive!
The word soon reached the top of the gorge by megaphone. A tremendous roar went up from the crowd and was heard on the American side of the river. They gave an answering cheer, and both boats of the Maid of the Mist Company blew their whistles in salute to the brave woman.
If it was with my dying breath, I would caution anyone against attempting the feat. I would sooner walk up to the mouth of a cannon, knowing it was going to blow me to pieces, and make another trip over the falls.
Annie Edson Taylor, a woman of indomitable resolve, of lion-like courage, a woman who had the strength of her conviction.
I certainly would have jumped off the bridge or gone over the falls in an attempt to kill myself if I had been prevented. I have very urgent reasons for making the trip, and if I had failed, I certainly would have committed suicide.
So she's done her stunt. She must be thinking, well, now I've done it. Now I will be able to regain my place in society. I will be able to provide for myself, perhaps pay back my relatives. The problem was her manager. Her manager had not set up anything ahead of time. He did not rent bleachers as the wire walkers had, so there were no tickets to sell. He had not booked train reservations and resold the seats, which is what the other wire walkers had also done, so that when people came in from Niagara, they got a cut of that. The only money that was planned to be made on the day of the event was to sell signed photographs, which I'm sure they sold a certain amount, but it was no big shakes. Russell did manage to get her to appear at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo. And she was a big hit. People were standing in line 6 hours to see her.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Queen of the Mist, the heroine of Niagara Falls, the first person to go over Niagara Falls and survive, Mrs. Annie Edson Taylor.
So she was ready for the next step. She was ready for Russell to book her into the lecture tour. All he could find were dime museums, and she was horrified at that. She thought that that was beneath her standard, so she refused. Now, after not getting any work for a while, she relented, and Russell booked her into a series of appearances at department stores, where she would sit in a department store window with her barrel, and that would be the attraction. I think it was probably quite demeaning for her.
To my friend, Al Tanner, manager of the Lyceum Theater, March 26th, 1902. Dear Mr. Tanner, I write from Cincinnati. In the months since accomplishing my feat over the falls, I have traveled through Michigan, Ohio, and South Carolina, giving lectures and making appearances where possible. My great mistake was in selecting as manager Frank M. Russell. He keeps most of the takings for himself. Now he has absconded with my barrel. I have reason to believe he has secreted the barrel in Bay City, Michigan. Now, Mr. Tanner, I want to ask you if you cannot see some way to lend me the money to go after the barrel. It would cost $25. I've tried every way possible to get the money, and despair, as bitter as death, has settled down on me. I plead with you in God's name to try in some way to help me. Be my friend, and I will be yours, for I can make money with the barrel. Sincerely, Annie Edson Taylor.
So finally she got her barrel back. She hired a new manager. His name was William Banks. She thought she would do better with him. They started working county fairs and the like. Again, not much money came in, and unfortunately, again, her manager left her, took the barrel, only this time he hired a pretty young thing to impersonate Annie, and so he went across the country with this supposed Annie Taylor and the barrel and made a lot of money, once again cutting Annie out. Then I think maybe the final indignity was the fact that the two rivermen who had assisted her on the actual drop made a movie of an empty barrel going over Niagara Falls, and they sold that to the Nickelodeons as if it were a record of the actual event. And, of course, Annie didn't get any of that money either.
My life since going over the falls has been one of trial and persecution. Not once have I ever seen in any paper or magazine a true version of the trip over the falls. Nor have the thousands of people who came to see me, with few exceptions, ever thought of the fact that I had the brain to plan such a trip and the courage to make it. They thought of nothing but how much money I got. I know well enough most people despise me for what I accomplished. They are cowards. But I don't care what they say or think. I know how the world heaps sudden glory on the achiever. Then just as quickly, they treat that person with scorn. I'm no fool. I've learned the hard way how little the world really cares.
She eventually wound up alone. She went back to Niagara Falls City. She would sit on the sidewalk. She got a barrel. It wasn't her original barrel, but it was a barrel. And she would sit there and sell postcards. And she did that for 20 years. And she was basically just a wrinkled old woman who was a curiosity on the streets. It's really sad.
I would say that she definitely was murdered in a very slow, painful, irritating way through poverty, through, you know, being condescended to. She was robbed by her manager. He stole her barrel. He stole the original barrel. She tried to sell pictures of herself you know, with the barrel and just couldn't make any money. And I think it had to do with the fact that she was not a sexy young thing. She was not a man. And so what else should a woman of a certain age do in 1901? Well, she should disappear. And how do you disappear? You end up in a poorhouse.
Niagara County Infirmary, February 1921. Through misfortune and other people's dishonesty, I lost all of my fortune. It is quite a change for me to come here, when I have been used to being entertained in senators' homes in Washington and traveling extensively, but I feel that it is no disgrace. And if all my plans materialize, I shall not remain here long.
Annie Edson Taylor died in the poorhouse at Niagara Falls in 1921. Not the Usual Carnival Show-Off was produced by Catherine Franey. The sound engineers were Stephen Tilley and Judy Rapley. Readings by Jane Harders, Chris Cookavinas and Paul Comrie Thompson. For more details, head to the Hindsight webpage. Now we're spinning back a few decades to mid-19th century Australia and the tales of two notorious women who whipped up a moral panic. Lola Montez is best known as the showgirl of the Ballarat Goldfields, but she was more than just a dancer. Born in Ireland as Maria Eliza Gilbert, she manoeuvred her way through the salons and palaces of a Europe constantly on the cusp of revolution and war. And while Lola dazzled and shocked colonial Australia with her spider dance, German emigre Caroline Hodgson, wife of a respectable English landowner, was setting up shop in boomtime Melbourne. By the time of her death in 1908, Hodgson had established 8 elite brothels in the city's red light district and had become immortalised as Madame Brussels, the queen of Melbourne's harlotry. In this feature, you'll hear historians Dr. Claire Wright, Professor Shirley Swain, Professor Ray Francis, and author Lenny Robinson, who re-examined the lives of these two entrepreneurial women, looking beyond the sex, scandal, and moral pandemonium. The Australian Etiquette Guide, 1880. A lady walks quietly through the streets, seeing and hearing nothing that she ought not to see nor hear. She's unobtrusive, never talks loudly or laughs boisterously. Above all, a lady never seeks to attract the attention or admiration of persons of the other sex.
I guess looking back from the 21st century, what would strike you is that sex is everywhere, but it's not spoken of, and it can't be spoken of except in euphemisms.
A lady never seeks to attract the attention or admiration of persons of the other sex.
Where we're walking now, which is Spring Street, which is right near Parliament House, very close proximity, you know, 5-minute walk, probably in the very footsteps of gentlemen on their way to the brothel.
Madame Brussels' establishment.
A certain Madame Brussels by name.
I set my sights on Madame Brussels.
Are you aware, sirs, that some little time since you might have seen parading the block in Collins Street the accursed procuress, Madame B?
When I started looking for Madame Brussels, my search for Madame Brussels, the first person I came across was, of course, the Queen of Harlotry, and she intrigued me, you know, and I was attracted by that sort of burlesque, cartoonish figure.
Whatever Lola wants.
Lola just wanted to break every mould that was put in front of her. And I think that she was just driven by survival.
Little Lola wants you.
Que matan a los hombres más cabales. Lola Montez has daggers for eyes that kill the most righteous of men.
Now, how many men have you actually had out there?
Well, I haven't had him.
Lola was a terrible homemaker. She couldn't keep one. She was married 3 times. She had lovers. 2 of her husbands mysteriously died. She was charged and tried with bigamy at one point. And she acknowledges that marriages for her were like a social experiment. Clearly an experiment that she failed.
The madam skimped on nothing and always was rewarded handsomely, as were her girls.
She, from what I could gather, that she actually worked well with her staff. You know, they tended to support her when she appeared in court. She left 2 houses to her manageress, so she tended to care for the women around her. But we can't ignore the fact she still made her living by commodifying women.
The Victorian woman ideally was chaste, that she was monogamous, that she only had sex inside marriage with her own husband. So any kind of extramarital affairs on the behalf of women were seen as extremely morally reprehensible.
Victoria should be declared an infected province until its moral character has been renovated and its reputation restored. The Bulletin, November 1893.
Lola Montez was born Maria Eliza Dolores Rosanna Gilbert in 1818 in Limerick, Ireland. She was off to a rocky start from the beginning. Her mother was actually 14 years old when she was married. Lola was then educated in India and Scotland and France and England until her mother betrothed Lola to a 60-year-old judge of the Supreme Court in India. And Lola was less than enthused about this idea. She was already a spirited girl. She had a fiery temperament and she clashed horribly with her mother. So she fled and she eloped with a young officer in the British Army. And her new husband had an affair and left her quite quickly. So she was really on her own. Poor and sporadically educated, and her first marriage was a train wreck. And it was really important for her to be able to provide for herself. So she went to Spain, where she learned to dance. Many commentators were quick to point out that Lola was not a good dancer, that she was a very mediocre dancer. So although that's the thing that we now remember her most for, it was actually probably the least of her talents. But she did learn to dance in Spain. And she also assumed her stage name, if you want, Lola Montez. The Lola came from the Dolores part of her name. And she also was playing up on the Moorish Spanish heritage that she said that her mother had. So she was cherry-picking from her past to be able to provide this new identity for herself. She was very ambitious and she was very much a self-made woman. She went from Spain back to London and she made her debut on the London stage in 1843. And from that point she travelled through Europe. She went to Paris and Munich and Warsaw and to St. Petersburg. And it was during these European adventures that she got to know many of the famous men who became influential in her life and who in turn she influenced. Lola was a close confidant of Emperor Nicholas I of Russia, with whom she spoke about politics and they discussed matters of state quite openly. Franz Liszt was one of her lovers. Alexandre Dumas was one of her lovers. She eventually became engaged again to a man called Alexandre Dugarrier, who was an editor, democrat, rabble-rouser. Dugarrier died in a duel in 1845 before they were able to wed. Lola said afterwards she wished it had been her that had have gone to the duel because she would have been much better with the weapon than he had have been. So again she found herself alone. At this point she went to Munich. And this is where she came to know King Ludwig I of Bavaria. He was 60 years old and she was 22. And although people believe from the outside that he was enamoured by her looks and the possibilities of her very evident sexuality, She maintained that he loved her for her political beliefs and her brain, and she became enormously influential in the politics of Bavaria at the time.
Lonsdale Street. The very name reeks with the sexual sin of the place and the record of the souls that have been eternally damned there.
I guess the most general way to put it is that Madame Brussels was a notorious 19th century Melbourne madam from the latter half of the century, whose brothel was particularly notorious because she catered for the elite classes of Melbourne. Her life charts the trajectory of Melbourne during that period. But, you know, she came to Australia in 1871. She went into the sex industry most likely as a manager of a brothel, very quickly bought her own brothels on Lonsdale Street, at the top of Lonsdale Street, two buildings, bought one and then the other next to it, and then owned and operated around eight brothels in the same area, in the sort of red light district, which was up on Lonsdale Street, and just had this meteoric rise to become like the queen of Melbourne harlotry, running one of the most best, most elite brothels in Melbourne, to, as you know, rode that through the 1880s, and then as the city did, come 1890, her fortunes changed dramatically. And through the 1890s, I think it was really a steady decline for her in sort of economic terms, probably in personal terms, to, you know, the dwindling of her career in the very early 20th century up till her death.
Madame Brussels was the owner of one of the most fashionable whorehouses in Melbourne, whose back gate on Gorman Alley opened onto Little Lonsdale Street, and her rather modest front door standing at number 32 to 34 Lonsdale Street, brazenly welcoming the wealthy graziers, the Toorak set, the gentlemen of influence and power, from the clergy to the politicians.
So here we are in Melbourne, and we're sort of walking the path of Carolyn's life in some respects. So this is the site where Carolyn's brothel would have been. However, at the time when Carolyn had this site, there were two buildings back from the street they're described as being, covered with lattice, so they were quite discreet.
At Madame Brussels, I heard, you were taught how to converse with men of all class, colour, creed and size.
She had a side entrance on Gorman Alley, and there was a rumour that she had keys cut to the door to that side entrance, which was a special place where her most valued clientele could enter without having to risk being seen entering Madame Brussels from the street.
The madam made certain that her girls were well turned out, were fed and taught manners fit for a lady, were regularly taken care of by a physician, and were paid very handsomely for our creativity.
The bordello of the imagination, by the sounds of things. It had a, I know it had a parlour because they talk about how it had a piano downstairs, and she apparently had a big picture of her lover on the piano. And they say it had carpets like meadow grass, and it had, you know, plaster busts of naked women. And it's, she had a garden out the back of her property, and it's said that on hot summer nights she'd have her girls semi-naked out the back, you know, in on display. But you know, the interesting thing is when you look at the records of the site, you had people living behind there, you know, in Little Lawn, homes, families. Next door you had a pub, and it would have had a stable in the backyard. So whenever I was on the site, I'd always imagine the gentleman opening the top windows for a breath of fresh air and the smell of horse dung wafting up and, you know, the sounds of families. So I think it was quite contrasting.
Lola was in Munich at the time of those sweeping revolutions in 1848. She was, in fact, carried away on that tide. Because Ludwig had made her the Countess Marie von Landsfeld, the people really turned against her. And at the same time, she'd made bitter enemies because the clergy, who she had been trying to get out of the political machinations of German politics, were scornful, hateful of her. Eventually, Ludwig abdicated, and they both became exiles. Lola returned to England, where she married a man called George Heald in 1849. This is the point at which she is charged with bigamy. But Heald, in fact, drowned mysteriously in 1850. Again, poor Lola was left on her own. But she was left on her own at an exciting time in world history because the gold rush had just started in California. And so 1850, she's off to the gold rushes.
With the gold ran out in California, thousands of prospectors scrambled onto every available ship across the Pacific down under. But the miners demanded entertainment, and no one created quite as much excitement and trouble as Lola Montez. Singer, dancer, lover to the crowned heads of Europe, when Lola visited the gold fields of Ballarat, she set the place alight.
Fortunately for Lola, who seems to be dogged by both tragedy and luck, gold has been discovered in Victoria. So she now joins the exodus to the Australian goldfields. Lola's tour of Australia lasted for 10 months. They were 10 months of unmitigated controversy. Right from the start, she had problems. She was sued by her American troop for non-payment of wages. She was pursued by the police out of Sydney. She came to Melbourne in a storm of bad reviews, and the reputation of her being a whore, of her act being immoral, licentious. And of course, this is what her impresarios banked on. This is why everybody wanted to have Lola Montez on their show bill, because she drew a crowd.
If the management of the Theatre Royal aim at securing public patronage by such performances, they have no right to insult respectable ladies by inviting their attendance. And if scenes of this kind are ever to be repeated, we consider that the interference of the authorities is imperatively called for to put them down as a nuisance and as utterly subversive to all ideas of public morality.
The Contessa Lola Montez!
She took to the Melbourne stage. She performed Lola Montez in Bavaria. She performed her spider dance. But she was hounded by bad press everywhere. She was satirised by Melbourne Punch. And once on the goldfields, she, in a way, found her niche, because the goldfields were a place of democratic upheaval, of social flux, of roles being recast, of fortunes being made and lost. Lola becomes the image of the high-kicking, good-time girl, gold-digger type who we imagine would go to the goldfields. You would think that if ever there was a milieu in which Lola Montez would find a comfortable niche, this would be it. And yet she still was a lightning rod for dissent. Lola left Victoria 10 months after she had arrived, broke because it hadn't been a financially successful tour, and sailing headlong into tragedy again. She arrived back in California bereaved and sick. Lola had been suffering from syphilis since at least 1850. What she decided to do this time, rather than taking to the stage, she decided to write her autobiography. But it's fairly clear that she was on the verge of madness. And it was not long before she died alone in 1861 at the age of 43.
Are you aware, sirs, that some little time since you might have seen parading the block in Collins Street the accursed procuress, Madame B, in charge of a beautiful girl under 20 with a white feature in her hat, telling by advertisement that maiden virtue was to be had for a price in her gilded den?
Oh,
be a woman in this town.
Oh, yeah, unless you're one of them beauties parading up and down Collins Street.
Oh,
not the new girl Madame Brussels has.
Oh, you seen her, eh? Oh, la-dee-da,
right? Satin and lace. Fanning around with that big hat, white feather sitting up high in it to show her virginity was to be had for a very pretty price in the Madame Salon.
That's right, and it's every Saturday afternoon. Ah, a bit of boomerang virginity, I call it. Lucky they got so many chooks in their backyards to keep up the supply of feathers.
Ah, you are a one.
It's kind of 19th century feels. Henry Varley, who was an evangelist who made many trips to Australia, you know, preaching God's good word, I think it was 1889, he tried to move a case against her for solicitation. Varley really had it in for her. He saw her as the symbol of decadence in Melbourne. And she slipped under the radar. That was the problem. No one could get her. She knew too many powerful people, I think. And he managed to find two girls who would testify that they'd been solicited, and he followed them back to the broth, and he got as far as the courtroom. The case was aborted because the prosecution couldn't be there, and I don't know how they were held up, goodness me. But I think there's no evidence to suggest it, but I think Madame Brussels knew some powerful people, and she had a lot of big secrets on those powerful people. So I don't think it was any coincidence. But the court case did actually end up taking place about 5 days later. And, you know, the girls had histories which included going to dancing houses, which is indicative of their moral character. And one of the girls said that she had lost her innocence the summer before or something. So they couldn't get her on those charges. And then they tried to get her on the charge of just owning a brothel. But the police testified it was discreet, it was well run, it was in the right area, there was no law really against it. So basically she got off, which absolutely rankled by Henry Varley, and he tried again to bring her to court 2 years later.
Prostitution was seen as a threat to gender roles because it was the opposite to everything that women were supposed to be. They weren't sexually restrained, they weren't sexually monogamous, they didn't do it in their homes, they did it in public.
But there's also a stream of thought which comes down through medicine particularly that she's performing a really important social duty. You just put prostitutes in a complete class apart, meeting a very necessary need, match that with respectable middle-class men delaying marriage so they can build up an income, and men who within marriage try to protect their wives from undue sexual activity because they don't want to have too many pregnancies. And you can see that there's a kind of market there for a high-class prostitution. So there's that stream, and someone like Madame Brussels, in a way, sits in between two. Yes, she can be publicly vilified, and everyone does, but a lot of the men who do the vilifying are also taking advantages of her services.
At that time, women who were involved in prostitution would tend to be seen as victims, and these evil madams went and preyed upon their weaknesses and drew them into the sex industry. So a special place was reserved for madams as kind of betrayers of their sex.
The young female should be protected. Our duty to God and to our nationhood demands it.
Well, this was the age of the new woman, as she was called with capital letters, the feminist who was going to move into the public sphere and demand to be treated as a citizen, demand the right to vote, demand the right to have access to so-called men's professions. And this was a very unsettling period for many men. And the new woman was threatening precisely because she threatened to usurp the position and the privileges that men believed belonged to them by nature. So she was seen as unnatural, and particularly if she was single, she was characterised as a dried-up spinster or as some kind of licentious public woman.
Madame Brussels' death coincided with suffrage for women in Australia, but like it was the same year that she died. But one of the reasons the sex industry suffered so much toward the turn of the 20th century was there were many reasons, like we had the evangelists coming through in the 1890s, but it was the rise of the suffrage movement, the women's movement, that really brought to an end the sex industry because they saw it as exploitative and it needed to be got rid of, essentially. And so, in a way, Madame Brussels' decline was heralded by advances for women.
Lola was a self-made woman. She believed in self-reliance. She believed that women could be powerful and should exert influence. But she didn't believe in women's suffrage. The big causes, the big political causes for women at the time were women's suffrage and the Bloomer movement. Lola hated both of them. She didn't believe that every woman should have the vote because she essentially believed that most women were silly, vacuous creatures that could never and should never be taken seriously. In her biographical writing, she referred to women as inane pieces of human waxwork.
She's an inane piece of human waxwork, whose life has consisted merely of powdering, drinking tea, going to the opera, flirting and sleeping. She may have been useful as a pretty piece of statuary to fill a nook in a private house or as a pleasant piece of furniture for a drawing room.
Most women accepted that in the absence of formal rights, they wielded influence, or the only power they had was through their ability to manipulate men, through whether you call it feminine charm or sexuality.
They're economically successful in the way in which they construct a life. They're successful in a certain strata of male society. They're not successful in women's company. They're not going to get invited to lunch at the Government House, you know.
They said that if Madame Brussels ever sort of opened her mouth, divorce papers would have flown around Melbourne. However, that power is really limited in the sense that she couldn't have a public face. You know, she wanted this kind of public prestige that's associated with a good name, but her good name would be constantly smeared by her occupation.
Well, I think that Lola Montez was very much a woman of her time, but tragically before her time also. A woman who could be sexually exciting and dangerous and gregarious, but also highly educated, cultured, literate, articulate, and engaged in political affairs.
Where does the feminine charm end and the sexuality begin? And women had to be very careful that they didn't step over that line, because if they stepped over that line, then they ran the risk of being disempowered. They become marked as fallen women. And men actually didn't like it when women didn't use their sexuality. When they demanded, you know, formal equality, in fact, they'd prefer to be manipulated than to accord women equal status.
Such is the social and moral fabric of the world that woman must be content with an exceedingly narrow sphere of action, or she must take the worst consequences of daring to be an innovator and a heretic. She must be either the servant or the spoiled plaything of man. There are no rules of woman's social and moral being which can justly be applied to those whose more positive nature forces them out into that mighty field of the world, where the crowd and the crush of opposing interests come together in the perpetual battle we know as life.
Readings in today's program were by Claire Larman, Maureen Hartley and Humphrey Bauer. It was produced by Lucy Bracey and the sound engineer was Angie Grant. I'm Michelle Rayner, and do join us on Hindsight next week when scientist Tony Fleming journeys to Antarctica in the footsteps of his grandfather, Raymond Priestley, one of the surviving members of Scott's polar expedition in 1911, 100 years ago this year. That's Hindsight next week. Look forward to your company then.